Test.
Check this out.
Ranger.
Autonomous Action Radio, a multimedia radio show, a website, an idea, a suggestion, an action plan. Because it's up to us now.
This communique will most likely be marked and destroyed shortly after it is discovered. Listen on at your own risk.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Autonomous Action Radio. I'm your friendly anarchist host, Linda. Autonomous Action Radio comes to you directly from the streets of resistance. Although in the words of Rage Against the Machine, the front line is everywhere. The global resistance is taking on this destructive culture in forests, mountains, deserts, farms, and even the rivers, bays, and oceans. This week we're going through some more of the anarchist alphabet. Last week we went through A, B, and C, but we're not quite finished with C yet. There's a few more C words to investigate. So far I've mentioned coexistence, collectivism, cooperation, and we've looked further at class war and Noam Chomsky, which leaves Chumbawamba, consensus, the coup, combat wombat, creative commons, and conspiracy. It's easy to generalize and place all conspiracy theories in the helm of tinfoil hat-wearing wingnuts who spend way too much time on the internet watching Alex Jones videos. But there's conspiracy theories, and there's conspiracy theories. The fact that governments and corporations don't tell us everything and distort the truth is undeniable. And there are many instances where it is proven that governments acted secretly to further their interest. For example, America's sponsorship of military coups in order to enact regime change in certain countries for various ideological, political, and economic reasons.
The first thing that happens is that the regime in question starts bothering some American company. They start demanding that the company pay taxes or that it observe labor laws or environmental laws. Sometimes that company is nationalized or is somehow required to sell some of its land or its assets. So the first thing that happens is that an American or a foreign corporation is active in another country, and the government of that country starts to restrict it in some way or give it some trouble, restrict its ability to operate freely. Then the leaders of that company come to the political leadership of the United States to complain about the regime in that country. In the political process, in the White House, the motivation morphs a little bit. The U.S. government does not intervene directly to defend the rights of a company, but they transform the motivation from an economic one into a political or geostrategic one. They make the assumption that any regime that would bother an American company or harass an American company must be anti-American, repressive, dictatorial, and probably the tool of some foreign power or interest that wants to undermine the United States. So the motivation transforms from an economic to a political one, although the actual basis for it never changes. Then it morphs one more time when the U.S. leaders have to explain the motivation for this operation to the American people. Then they do not use either the economic or the political motivation, usually, but they portray these interventions as liberation operations, just a chance to free a poor, oppressed nation from the brutality of a regime that we assume is a dictatorship, because what other kind of a regime would be bothering an American company?
However, just because some conspiracy theories have proven correct, it is unwise to accept every colourful pronouncement regarding our reptilian overlords and their links to the International Jewish Banker Cartel or the local chapter of the Masonic Lodge. We need to judge conspiracy theories as we would judge any theory and decide on their validity by evaluating the evidence we can find that supports them, or indeed, a lack of evidence. Evaluating the credibility of the evidence found to support something is also key when judging conspiracy theories. Alex Jones or Truthers.org are not credible sites as they fail to cite independent sources or sources that are difficult to verify. Our resident badass anarchist philosopher Gerald Keeney has more to say on the subject.
So every conspiracy theory should be assessed on its own merits and in terms of how it's used the evidence. What about the conspiracy theory that those in power planning for a single world government? Well, the problem with this, is an interesting illustrative point actually, the problem with this is it discounts the fact that in the market there's competition. Now, competition doesn't suggest a single world government, it suggests a whole series of different governments that represent different competing forces in the market, and it looks like what we've got, right? And of course you could object and you could say, well, those governments all want to be unified against what? Well, by the sounds, it's like against the market itself. It sounds like the old fears of Stalinism, that bureaucracy will overwhelm free enterprise. But the problem with this theory is that it doesn't really explain then where governments come from. I mean, if you say governments represent the market, you've got an explanation for governments. And you've got an explanation which is synced into some of our best theories, for instance, Marxist theories, other theories, and you've got one that matches the facts. If you just say that governments come out of nowhere and that people can engineer one world governments irrespective of the economic basis on which these governments are supposed to rest, then it looks like you haven't got a very good explanation for governments themselves. So I think when a conspiracy theory runs into these incompatibilities with good explanations we already have, yeah, that's a good reason to strike some points against it and to be suspicious of it. And I think the one world government conspiracy theory is an example of that.
Look at it. A young trophy wife marries this guy for his money. She figures he isn't giving her enough. You know, she owes money all over town.
Fucking.
It's all goddamn fake, man. It's like Lenin said, you look for the person who will benefit, and
I am the walrus.
You know, you know what I'm trying to say.
I am the walrus.
Fucking bitch.
Oh, yeah.
I am the walrus.
Shut the fuck up, Donnie. The I, Lenin. Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov.
What the fuck is he talking about?
If you've ever seen the movie The Big Lebowski, there's a couple of references to the work of Comrade Lenin. And in it, Lenin is described as holding the view that if something happens that's got mysterious origins, but the benefits power, or those in power, we should suspect those in power because they've got the capacity to have instigated the event in question. I've read a bit of Lenin, and I've never read that in Lenin. I don't know whether he says it or not. I'm not a Lenin scholar, but it is a very interesting idea. Another way you might look at it is to think like this. Imagine Mrs. Plum stands to inherit $1 million if Professor White is killed. And let's say Professor White is killed in the library with the lead pipe. And let's say we know that Mrs. White had access to the lead pipe and could have gone to the library. Well, then because she inherits the $1 million upon the death of Professor White, she's our prime suspect. And I think that this often applies in the case of conspiracy theories. If you can get a conspiracy theory that does stand up to the evidence, and that does suggest that power has done something that it may benefit from having done, then it's got prima facie plausibility. And as far as I'm concerned, power should be accused as guilty until proven innocent. And power should have to justify itself and should take seriously, or should be forced to take seriously, the accusations levelled against it. And I think it's often got beneficial effects. It causes power to be much more circumspect. For instance, I think the fact that a lot of people accused the Bush and Blair regime of having masterminded the attacks that they then used as an excuse for to introduce tougher laws at home and for wars overseas, may well, if there's something to those conspiracy theories, may well have saved umpteen thousand lives when those same people or their minions were less willing to stage or to use brainwashed operatives or however else they did it to stage new terror attacks.
So the light bulb in my study blew, and then the light bulb in my bedroom, which I guess means I'll use slightly less electricity, but also got me thinking about this documentary I watched recently called The Light Bulb Conspiracy. I remember hearing in primary school about how light bulbs could in fact be made so they didn't blow and need replacing. But it wasn't until I watched this doco that I realised how much thought and planning went into exactly how long they lasted. As revealed in the film, during the 1920s, a secret cartel was set up for the purposes of limiting the lifespans of light bulbs. This is called planned obsolescence, and the documentary reveals it is in no way limited to light bulbs. Things don't seem to last these days because they're built that way. iPods, printers, washing machines, toasters, and even stockings. And it's not just dodgy manufacturing. According to the film, it's chips put into printers so they stop working after a certain number of hours, and serious testing and planning of clothing to rip or otherwise fall apart.
This is Marcos from Barcelona, but he could be anyone, anywhere. What is about to happen to him occurs daily in offices and homes all over the world. A part inside the printer has failed, and the manufacturer sends Marcos to technical support.
Well, the technician can diagnose the problem, but it'll cost 15 euros plus VAT.
It's hard to get the parts for...
Realistically, it's not worth repairing.
Repair costs you about 110-120 euro.
New printers start from 39 euros.
I recommend you buy a new printer.
It's best to buy a new one.
It's no coincidence that all three shopkeepers suggest buying a new printer. If he agrees, Marcos will become yet another victim of planned obsolescence, the secret mechanism at the heart of our consumer society.
Our role in life seems to be just to consume things with credit, to borrow money, to buy things we don't need.
We live in a system based on a growth economy. We don't grow in order to satisfy needs. We grow in order to grow.
So if the consumer does not purchase, you know, the economy is not going to grow.
Planned obsolescence. The desire on the part of a consumer to own something a little newer, a little sooner than is necessary.
This film will reveal how planned obsolescence has defined our lives ever since the 1920s, when manufacturers started shortening the lives of products to increase consumer demand.
Let's just limit the lifetime of each bulb to 1,000 hours.
We will find out how designers and engineers were made to adopt new values and objectives.
Was back to the drawing board and come out with something that was more fragile.
They time those things. They time them. So when you finally paid for them, they're used up.
A new generation of consumers has started challenging manufacturers. Is it possible to imagine a viable economy without planned obsolescence, without its impact on the environment?
Posterity will never forgive us. Posterity will suddenly find out about the throwaway lifestyles of people in the advanced countries.
The light bulb conspiracy. The untold story, planned obsolescence.
Welcome to Livermore, California. home of the longest burning light bulb in the world. My name's Lynn Owens, and I am chairman of the Light Bulb Committee. It was in 1972 when we discovered that the light bulb that was hanging in the fire station was a significant light bulb.
The light bulb at the Livermore Fire Station has been burning continuously since 1901. Ironically, the bulb has already outlasted two webcams. In 2001, when the bulb was 100 years old, the people of Livermore threw a big birthday party, American style.
I think we were hoping if we would get 200 people, we'd be happy. And we ended up with 800 or 900 people showing up.
One nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Do you think that anybody would sing happy birthday to a light bulb? Well, we didn't think they would, but they did.
The origin of the bulb was, it was produced in a town called Shelby, Ohio, back around 1895, and put together by some very interesting ladies that I have some pictures of, and some gentlemen that invested in the company. The filament was invented by Adolphe Chollet. He invented his filament to last. Why does his filament last? I don't know. It's a secret that he made, and that died with him.
Chollet's formula for a long-lasting filament is not the only mystery in the history of the light bulb. A much bigger secret is how the humble light bulb became the first victim of planned obsolescence.
Marcus Krajewski, historian. Christmas 1924 was a very special day. In a back room in Geneva, there was a meeting of suited men with a secret plan. They started the first worldwide cartel. Its mission, to control bulb production in every country in the world, to split up the market between its members. This cartel was called Phoebus.
Phoebus included the main light bulb manufacturers in Europe and the United States, and even faraway colonies in Asia and Africa.
The goal was, by exchanging patents, to control production, and especially to control the consumers. It was better for these companies if the consumer regularly bought new bulbs. So if the bulbs lasted too long, that was obviously a disadvantage.
Initially, manufacturers strived for a long lifespan for their bulbs.
On October 21st, 1871, numerous experiments resulted in the production of a small unit lamp of comparatively enormous resistance. The filament began under conditions of great stability.
Thomas Edison's first commercial bulb, on sale by 1881, lasted 1,500 hours. By 1924, when the Phoebus cartel was founded, manufacturers proudly advertised lifespans of up to 2,500 hours and stressed the longevity of their bulbs.
Phoebus thought, let's just limit the lifetime of each bulb to 1,000 hours. In 1925, they started a committee called the 1,000-Hour Life Committee, which was to work out how the lifetime of bulbs could be limited in this way.
More than 80 years later, Helmut Hüge, an historian from Berlin, uncovers proof of the committee's activities hidden in the internal documents of the founding members of the cartel, such as Philips in Holland, Osram in Germany, and Compagnie des Lampes in France.
Here we have a cartel
from the cartel.
There steht, the average life of lamps for general lighting service must not be guaranteed, published, or offered for another value than 1,000 hours.
Under pressure from the cartel, member companies conducted experiments to create a more fragile bulb that would conform with the new 1,000-hour rule. Bulb production was monitored rigorously to make sure cartel members complied.
One method used a huge rack with a lot of sockets. Various bulbs from different manufacturers were screwed in, and companies such as Osram measured exactly how long they worked before breaking.
Osram haben dann genauestens protokolliert, wie lange diese Lampen brannten.
Davis enforced its rules through an elaborate bureaucracy. Members were fined heavily if their monthly life reports were off the mark.
Here is a table of fines from 1929, which shows exactly how many Swiss francs in fines each company had to pay. For example, for each bulb which lasted over 1,500 hours.
Zum Beispiel 1,500 Stunden.
As planned obsolescence took effect, lifespans fell steadily. In just 2 years, they dropped from 2,500 hours to less than 1,500 hours. By the 1940s, the cartel had reached its goal. 1,000 hours had become the standard lifespan for bulbs.
I can see how this was very tempting in 1932. I think at the time, sustainability was actually substantially less of an issue because I don't think they looked at the planet as being one with finite amount of resources. They looked at it as from an abundance perspective.
Ironically, the light bulb has always been a symbol for ideas and innovation, and yet it's one of the early and best examples of planned obsolescence.
In the following decades, inventors filed dozens of patents for new light bulbs, including one lasting 100,000 hours. None of them reached the general market.
Officially, Phoebus never existed, although clues to its existence were never completely eliminated. There was an idea behind it, which was to keep changing its name, so they switched its name to International Electricity Cartel, and then to other names. The main thing, of course, was that the idea lived on, whatever it was called.
In Barcelona, Marcos hasn't followed the advice of the shopkeepers to replace his printer. He's determined to repair it, and has found somebody on the internet who has discovered what has actually happened to his printer.
It's the dirty little secret of inkjet printers. I tried to print a document, and it said parts inside your printer require replacement, so I decided to do a little servicing of my own.
Hello, Marcos. I got your message.
Marcos has contacted the author of the video.
How are you? I looked into it, and it turns out that there's a thing in the bottom of the printer called a waste ink reservoir. And the way inkjet printers work is they constantly have to clean the print heads, and they do that by squirting ink through them down a hole in the bottom of the printer into this great big sponge. There's just a preset time when it's squirted a certain number of drops down there that then the printer decides it's full of ink and won't function anymore. Mm-hmm. The justification is they don't want us to put ink all over your desk. But I think the problem goes deeper than that. It's the way the technology works. It's just designed to fail.
Planned obsolescence emerged at the same time as mass production and the consumer society.
The whole issue with products being made to last less long is part of a whole pattern that began in the Industrial Revolution, when the new machines were producing goods so much more cheaply, which was a great thing for consumers, but consumers couldn't keep up with the machines. There was so much production.
As early as 1928, an influential advertising magazine warned that an article that refuses to wear out is a tragedy of business. In fact, mass production made many goods widely available. Prices fell and many people started shopping for fun rather than need. The economy was booming. In 1929, the emerging consumer society came to a full stop when the Wall Street crash sent the U.S. into a deep economic recession.
Unemployment reached staggering proportions. By 1933, one-fourth of our labor force was unemployed.
People no longer queued for goods, but for work and for food. From New York came a radical proposal on how to kickstart the economy again. Bernard London, a prominent real estate broker, suggested ending the Depression by making planned obsolescence compulsory by law. It was the first time the concept was put into writing. Under Bernard London's proposal, all products would be given a lease of life with a set expiry date, after which they would be considered legally dead. Consumers would turn them over to a government agency where they would be destroyed.
He was trying to achieve a balance between capital and labor where there would always be a market for new goods. So there would always be a need for labor and there would always be a reward for capital.
Bernard London believed that with compulsory planned obsolescence, the wheels of industry would keep turning, people would keep consuming, and everyone would have a job. Giles Slade has come to New York to investigate the person behind the idea. He wants to find out if for Bernard London, planned obsolescence was purely about profits or about helping the unemployed.
I have a picture of Bernard London.
Dorothea Weitzner remembers meeting Bernard London in the 1930s during a family outing.
Don't tell me which one
okay.
he is.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh, isn't that interesting? Yes. Definitely intellectual looking.
And you met Bernard London in 1933.
When I was about 16, 17, my dad and mother had this big Cadillac car, which was the size of a Zeppelin. Mother was driving like a chauffeur. Dad was in the front, and Mr. and Mrs. London were in the back of the big limousine. Dad said that Mr. London should explain his philosophy to me. He's a very interesting man. And he just told me in a few words that that was his idea to reduce the Depression. We were in an economic mess, worse than today even. He was obsessed with this idea. Like an artist is utterly obsessed with his paintings, you know. He actually whispered to me in the car, afraid that his theory might be too radical.
In fact, Bernard London's proposal was ignored. And obsolescence by legal obligation was never put into practice. 20 years later, in the 1950s, the idea resurfaced, but with a crucial twist. Instead of forcing planned obsolescence on the consumers, they were to be seduced by it.
Planned obsolescence. The desire on the part of a consumer to own something a little newer, a little better, a little sooner than is necessary. We certainly in America...
This is the voice of Brooks Stevens, the apostle of planned obsolescence in post-war America. This flamboyant industrial designer created everything from household appliances to cars and trains, always with planned obsolescence in mind. In the spirit of the times, Brooks Stevens' designs conveyed speed and modernity. Even the house he lived in was unusual.
This is the home that my father designed and that I grew up in. When it was being built out in the suburbs, everybody thought it was going to be the new Greyhound bus station because it did not look like a traditional home. One of the most important things that my father felt always in designing a product is that it made a statement. He detested products that were bland and really did not, you know, create any desire within the consumer to inspire the purchase.
Unlike the European approach of the past, where they tried to make the very best product and make it last forever, meaning you bought such a fine suit of clothes that you were married in it and then buried in it and never a chance to renew it, the approach in America is one of making the American consumer unhappy with the product that he has enjoyed the use of for a period, have him pass it on to the second-hand market, and obtain the newest product with the newest possible look.
Brooks Stevens traveled all over the U.S. to promote planned obsolescence in speech after speech. His approach became the gospel of the time.
Women and men alike are increasingly interested in the look of things. They eagerly give their attention to what's new and beautiful and advanced.
Design and marketing seduced consumers into always craving the latest model.
My father never designed a product to intentionally fail or become obsolete for some functional reason in a short period of time. Planned obsolescence is absolutely at the consumer's discretion. No one is forcing the consumer to go into the store and purchase a product. They go in under their own free will. That's their choice.
Freedom and happiness through unlimited consumption. The American way of life in the 1950s became the foundation for the consumer society as we know it today.
So how often do you change your mobiles?
18 months.
Once a year.
Once a year. Once a year.
These days, planned obsolescence is an integral part of the curriculum at design and engineering schools. Boris Knuth lectures on the concept of product life cycle, a modern euphemism for planned obsolescence.
I went shopping for you. I've got a couple of things. A pan, salt, shirt, another shirt.
Students are taught how to design for a business world dominated by one single goal, frequent repeat purchase.
What I do, I pass these round, and you tell me what you think, how long it takes for them to fail, what the service life will be.
Designers have to understand what company they work for. The company decides on a business model, how often do we want to renew our products, our offers. So this brief is given to designers, and designers have to understand and design the product in a certain way so it fits exactly the business strategy of the client they work for.
Planned obsolescence is at the root of the substantial economic growth that the Western world has experienced since the 1950s. Ever since, growth has been the holy grail of our economy.
We live in a growth society in which the logic is not growing in order to meet needs, but growing in order to grow. Limitless growth in production, limitless and pointless growth in use.
Serge Latouche is a noted critic of the growth society and has written extensively about its mechanisms.
The three designing factors are advertising, planned obsolescence, and credit.
Et le crédit.
John Thackeray.
In the last generation or so, our role in life seems to be just to consume things with credit, to borrow money to buy things we don't need. That makes no real sense to me at all.
Critics of the growth society point out that it's unsustainable in the long run because it's based on a flagrant contradiction.
Those who believe in infinite growth on a finite planet are either mad or economists. Problem is, we've all become economists nowadays.
Why is it that a new product is created every 3 minutes somewhere in the world? Is this necessary? I think a lot of people have realized that things need to change when they're being told by politicians to go shopping or to start consuming as the best way to restart the economy.
With the consumer society, it's like we're sitting in a racing car. It doesn't have any brakes, and it's going at top speed. And in the end, we're bound to either hit a wall or go over a cliff.
Contre un mur, soit de sombrer dans un précipice.
Looking at the service manuals of different printers, Marcos realizes that the lifespan of many printers is set by the engineers right from the start. They achieve this by placing a chip deep inside the printer.
I found the chip. It's an EEPROM, which counts the number of prints. When it reaches a set count, it shuts off the printer. Black and white film credits. Alec Guinness, the man in the white suit.
How do engineers feel about designing products to fail? The dilemma is captured in a British film from 1951, where a young chemist invents an everlasting thread. He believes that great progress has been made.
There he is!
But not everyone is happy with his discovery. And soon he finds himself on the run, not only from the factory owners, but also from the workers, all fearing for their jobs.
Well, that's really interesting, and it reminds me of something that actually happened in the textile industry.
In 1940, the chemical giant DuPont announced the arrival of a revolutionary synthetic fiber, nylon. Girls celebrated the new long-lasting stockings, but the joy was short-lived.
My father worked for DuPont before and after the war in the nylon division, and he told me a story about how when nylon first came out and they were trying it out for use in stockings, the men in his division were asked to take these stockings home for their wives and girlfriends to try out. My father brought them home to my mother, and she was delighted with the first products because they were so sturdy.
The DuPont chemists had every reason to be proud of their achievement, as even men touted the strength of nylon stockings.
The problem was they lasted too long. The women were very happy with the fact that they didn't get runners in them. Unfortunately, this meant that the companies producing the stockings were not going to sell very many.
DuPont gave new instructions to Nichols Fox's father and his colleagues.
For the men in his division, it was back to the drawing board to try to make the fibers weaker and come out with something that was more fragile and would run so that the stockings wouldn't last as long.
The same chemists who'd applied their skills to make durable nylons went with the spirit of the times and made them more fragile. The everlasting thread disappeared from the factory floor, just like in the cinema.
We need control of this discovery. Complete control. If you want twice the amount in that contract, we will pay it.
A quarter of a million.
To suppress it. Yes.
How did the chemists at DuPont feel about deliberately reducing the life of a product?
Excuse me.
Must have been frustrating for the engineers to have to use their skills to make an inferior product after they'd tried so hard to make a good product. But in a way, I suppose, that's the outsider's view. Probably they just had a job to do. Make it strong, make it weak. That was their job.
Engineers were in a really complicated ethical time. This confrontation with planned obsolescence provoked them to examine their most basic ethical concepts. There was an old school of engineers who believed that they should make a permanent, usable product that would never break. And there was a new school of engineers that were driven by the market, who were clearly interested in making the most disposable product that they could. And this debate resolved itself by these new school of engineers taking over.
Planned obsolescence did not only affect engineers. The frustration of ordinary consumers is echoed in Arthur Miller's classic play, Death of a Salesman. Just like Willie Lomax, all consumers could do was complain powerlessly.
Once in my life, I'd like to own something outright before it's broken. I'm always in a race with the junkyard. Just finished paying for the car, and it's on its last legs. The refrigerator consumes belts like a crazy maniac. They time those things. They time them, so when you finally paid for them, they're used up.
Little did consumers know that on the other side of the Iron Curtain, in the countries of the Eastern Bloc, there was a whole economy without planned obsolescence. The communist economy was not ruled by the free market, but centrally planned by the state. It was inefficient and plagued by a chronic shortage of resources. In such a system, planned obsolescence did not make any sense. In former East Germany, the most efficient communist economy, official regulations stipulated that fridges and washing machines should work for 25 years.
Here, these are.
I bought this East German fridge in 1985, so it's at least 24 years old.
Mindestens 24 Jahre alt.
I've never had to change the bulb, which is also about 25 years old.
Fast 25 Jahre alt.
In 1981, a lighting factory in East Berlin launched a long life bulb. They took it to an international lighting fair, looking for buyers from the West.
The East German bulb manufacturers went to a lighting fair in Hannover in 1981. When they demonstrated their bulb, the West Germans thought, they want to put us out of business. The East Germans said, quite the opposite, by saving on tungsten, we're going to allow you to stay in business.
Behalten wir gerade unsere Arbeitsplätze.
The Western buyers rejected the bulb. In 1989, the Berlin Wall came down. The factory was closed, and the East German long life bulb went out of production. Now, it can only be found in exhibitions and museums. Years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, consumerism is as rampant in the East as it is in the West. But there is one difference. In the age of the internet, consumers are ready to fight against planned obsolescence.
The first movie we made that really broke through was a movie about the iPod. And I was completely broke. I had gotten this iPod, it was like $400. And about 8 months later, 12 months later maybe, the battery died in it. And I called Apple to ask them to replace the battery. And their policy at the time was to tell their customers to buy a new iPod.
You might as well go get a new one.
Apple doesn't offer?
No.
Apple doesn't offer a new battery for the iPod?
No.
It wasn't that the battery died that was annoying. Because in my Nokia cell phone, the battery dies, you buy a new battery. Even in my Apple laptop, when the battery would die, you replace the battery. But in the iPod, this expensive piece of hardware, when the battery died, you had to replace the entire unit. So it was my brother's idea to make a movie about just that. We went around with a stencil spray painting on every iPod advertisement we saw in town. iPod's unreplaceable battery lasts only 18 months. We put the video on our own little site, iPodsDirtySecret.com. In the first month, 6 weeks, it was at 5-6 million views. And the site went absolutely bananas.
A lawyer in San Francisco, Elizabeth Pritzker, heard about the video and together with her associates decided to sue Apple over the lifespan of the iPod battery. Half a century after the light bulb case, planned obsolescence was in court again.
When we brought this litigation, this was 2 years after the iPod was introduced, Apple had sold about 3 million iPods nationwide in the United States.
Many of the 3 million iPod owners were having battery problems and were willing to sue. One of them was Andrew Wesley.
We selected from amongst the consumers who had called us individuals who would serve as representatives in a class action. A class action is really a device that's fairly unique to the United States, where a small group of people stands in the shoes of a large group to bring one claim before court.
My role in that case was as class representative on behalf of thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people. The case came to be known as Wesley versus Apple. When my friends and family learned that this was a major case, they thought I was, you know, becoming a radical. You know, here I am going to sue. You know, I was the next Aaron Brockovich.
In December 2003, Elizabeth Pritzker filed the case at the San Mateo County Court, just a few blocks from the Apple headquarters.
asked Apple for a number of technical documents regarding the battery life in the iPod, and we received a lot of technical data about the battery design, about the testing of the battery, and learned through that discovery that the type of the lithium battery that was contained within this iPod was designed by design to really only have a short period of life. I do think that Apple's development of the iPod was intended to be one of planned obsolescence.
After a tense few months, both parties hammered out a settlement. Apple set up a replacement service for the batteries and extended the warranty to 2 years. The claimants were offered compensation.
One thing that really bothers me personally is that Apple really promotes itself as a young, hip, forward-thinking company, and for a company like that not to have a good environmental policy that allows consumers to return products for proper recycling and disposal is really counterintuitive and counter to their message.
Planned obsolescence produces a constant stream of waste, which is shipped to third world countries, such as Ghana in Africa.
It's been between 8 and 9 years now when I noticed that loads and loads of containers were coming to this country with electronic waste. We're talking about end-of-life computers, end-of-life television sets, which nobody wants in the developed countries.
Shipping electronic waste to third world countries is forbidden by international law, but the merchants use a simple trick. They declare the waste as second-hand goods. More than 80% of the electronic waste that arrives in Ghana is totally beyond repair, and whole container loads are abandoned at dump sites all around the country.
We are at the dump site here in Agbogbloshie. In the past, we had this beautiful river called Odor River, you know, that meandered its way through this area. It was teeming in the past. It had so much fish. We actually attended a school not very far away from here. So we'd come play football and hang around the river. The fishermen would organize boat rides, I remember very well. But now it's all finished, it's all gone. And that makes me really, really sad. And it makes me angry.
These days, there are no school kids playing here after class. Instead, youngsters from poor families come here looking for scrap metal. They burn the plastic-covered cables from the discarded computers to salvage the metal inside. What is left is picked through by the younger children who are looking for any tiny pieces of metal which the older boys may have missed.
Those behind the shipments have said that, well, we're trying to bridge the digital divide between Europe, America, and then the rest of Africa and Ghana, of course. But the reality is that these computers that are sent here simply do not work. There's no point in receiving electronic waste when you cannot deal with it, more so when you did not produce it and your country is being used as the world's trash bin.
The trash that for so long in the industrial age has been hidden from view is now coming into our lives, and we can actually no longer easily avoid it. The waste economy is reaching its last legs because they don't physically have anywhere else to put the waste.
I think in the course of time, we've come to realize that the planet that we're living on cannot sustain that forever. There's a limit to natural resources, and there's a limit to energy resources that we have.
Posterity will never forgive us. Posterity will certainly find out about the throwaway attitudes, the throwaway lifestyles of people in the advanced countries.
People all over the world have started acting against planned obsolescence. Mike Anani is fighting against it from the receiving end. He has started by collecting information.
This is where I keep the e-waste. They have asset tags or property tags. This says Amu Center, Nordvest, Zeeland. It's from Denmark. This is from Germany, sent here simply to be dumped. Westminster College. Apple should know better. It's a company that claims to be so green. There's a lot of Apple products that are being dumped here. I have a database that contains the asset tags, the contact addresses, telephone numbers of the companies that owned the electronic waste that have been dumped in Ghana.
Mike Anane plans to turn this information into evidence for a court case.
We need to take some action, some punitive measure. We need to sue people so they stop dumping e-waste in Ghana.
The website address is visible, ssclg.com.
Marcos is on the internet again, looking for a way to extend the life of his printer.
SSCLG.com.
He has discovered a Russian website which offers a free software for printers with a counter chip. The programmer has even gone to the trouble of explaining his personal motivation.
This happens due to bad construction. This is their business model. Not a good one for user and environment. So I looked and found a way to make user-friendly software to allow active users a resident input counter.
Marcos doesn't know what to expect, but downloads the software anyway. From a small village in France, John Thackera fights planned obsolescence by helping people share business and design ideas, ideas which come from all over the globe.
In all poorer countries, things are repaired automatically. The notion you throw a product away just because it breaks for some reason is completely unknowable and unthinkable, actually, to somebody in the South. In India, there's an actual word, jugaad, to describe this tradition of being able to fix things pretty much regardless of the complexity of it. We try to find people who are actively doing projects in the world rather than just talking about things or making abstract statements about how awful things are or what has to be changed.
One of these people is Warner Phillips, descendant of the dynasty of light bulb manufacturers.
I remember my grandfather taking me to one of the Phillips factories in Eindhoven to show me how light bulbs were mass manufactured in factories. Which is very, very cool.
Nearly 100 years after the creation of the light bulb cartel, Warner Phillips follows family tradition with a different approach. He produces an LED bulb which lasts 25 years.
It's not like there's a green world and there is a business world. I think business and sustainability go hand in hand. It's actually the best basis to build a business on. And the only real way to do that, I believe, is to factor in the true cost of the resources that have been used, but you also look at the energy consumption. You also look at the indirect energy consumption of transportation.
If transport has paid the real costs to the environment, to say nothing of the costs of using up the non-renewable resources like oil, the costs of transport might go up by a factor of 20 or 30.
If you factor all of that in into every product that you manufacture, then there will be huge incentives for manufacturers and entrepreneurs all over the planet to make products that last forever.
Fighting against planned obsolescence can also be achieved by rethinking the engineering and production of consumer goods. A new concept called Cradle to Cradle claims that if factories worked like nature, planned obsolescence itself would become obsolete.
Michael Braungart. When people talk about environmental protection, we think about saving, cutting back, minimizing resource use, avoiding waste. using less harmful materials and so on. But if you look at nature in the spring, like a cherry tree, it doesn't do that. It doesn't hold back or reduce its output.
Nature produces abundantly, but fallen blossoms, dead leaves, and other discarded materials are not waste. They become nutrients for other organisms. A cycle.
There is no waste in nature, just food.
Braungart believes that industry can imitate this virtuous cycle of nature. He proved that this is possible when he redesigned the production process of a Swiss textile company.
For example, take this material, which is used to cover sofas and chairs. The dyes used to make it so toxic that it cannot be discarded with ordinary household waste.
Braungart found that hundreds of highly toxic dyes and chemicals were routinely used at the factory. For the production of the new fabrics, Braungart and his team reduced the list to 36 substances, all biodegradable.
We choose only edible dyes. The goal is you should be able to cut it up into chunks and eat it on your breakfast cereal if you want to. In a disposable society, every short-lived product creates problems. But if we produce using biodegradable materials, every short-lived product is a chance to make something new.
For the more radical critics of planned obsolescence, reforming production is not enough. They want us to rethink our entire economic system and our values.
It's a real revolution which needs a cultural change. It's a paradigm shift, a change of thinking.
This revolution is called degrowth. Serge Latouche travels from conference to conference explaining how to get out of the growth society altogether.
Degrowth is a provocative slogan intended to break us out of the mindset which regards perpetual growth as possible, sustainable, which clarifies the need to change our logic. The main message of the degrowth movement is reduction, reducing our burden on the environment, reducing despoilation, reducing overproduction and overconsumption. By reducing time spent on making and consuming, we free up time so we can develop other forms of wealth which have gone unregarded, such as friendship, knowledge, and wisdom.
De ne pas s'épuiser quand on les consomme, comme l'amitié, le savoir.
We increasingly rely on objects to give us a sense of self-esteem and identity. Partly the consequence of the breakdown of things that used to give us identity, like membership of a community or relationship to the land or all sorts of soft and social things which have been replaced by consumerism.
If our happiness depends on our level of consumption, we should be 100% happy. We're using 26 times as much as people did in the time of Marx. But all investigations show that people are not 20 times happier, because happiness is always subjective.
Critics of degrowth fear that it will destroy the modern economy and take us straight back to the Stone Age.
But to go back to a society with sustainable development, it's not to go back to the Stone Age, but to go back to the 1960s. That's a long way from the Stone Age.
Ça n'est pas vraiment l'âge de pierre. On peut dire que la
degrowth fulfills Gandhi's vision. The world is big enough for everybody's needs, but will never be big enough for everybody's greed.
Marcos is installing the Russian freeware on his computer. The new software allows him to reset the counter chip inside his printer back to zero. The printer immediately unblocks.
You've been listening to Autonomous Action Radio on Z Digital For more information about the show, you can go to autonomousactionradio.com or 4ZZZFM.org.au.